Blog Talk Radio.
And here we are through the magic of the airwaves. Hello and good day to one and all, and good evening. You found Masonic Effects, and it's a pleasure to have this chance to sit in with you. A shout out to all of our listeners. Pleasure to have you here. Really is. And we're going to continue the conversation today. I can't help, you know, there's times when I think, oh my goodness, you know, what will we ever do to, or say to engage, to make this have, to make our time together purposeful. And then, you know, something odd happens. I find myself taking a deep breath, and all of a sudden it's so simple. It's so simple. You read, you think, you digest information, you have impressions, and we pull it together, and we begin to have an understandable sense of what's going on around us and ourselves. I don't know if somebody else can do this for you. I think, you know, at times you know yourself when you're measuring off what you are as a Freemason and what that entails and how that affects you. How does that define you? It doesn't make a callous man thoughtful. If he rebels in his own mind, you know, I think we begin to realize Masonry will open up our minds. And it is, if you were to ask me if this makes us more rigid or more flexible and adaptive, well, you know, I'll talk to you. Will it insult you? Well, there's not much a person can say. If you are of a mind that you're going to be insulted, that there's some topics that are sacred and only you alone understand you. You've heard that, you know. You don't understand me. You've not been through what I've been through. Well, actually, that's an interesting way of thinking, because there's validity to it. But, and you're waiting for the but. When I had the experience of talking to people about those kinds of ideas, that sense of of emotional and intellectual isolation. If you begin to pull it back, pull back the curtains a bit, if something has happened to you and it's traumatic, wasn't there with you, but I can certainly, and in all honesty, I can certainly associate what you're telling me with an experience that I have had. And it's not to push you off the palette here and say you're irrelevant. It's exactly the opposite. If you tell me something hurts and I talk to you so that I understand more and more about what it is you're describing, then it allows me to elicit a sense of compassion. When I'm frightened and lonely, and when I have been frightened and lonely and isolated and unsure about what comes next, it's a daunting, it's an awful feeling. It's frightening and it's isolating. And if what you're going through is in part like that, man, that's not something you wish on anybody. Now, is that understanding? And if you're looking to make, and if a person is looking to make that point of isolation, yes. It's not a quarrel or an argument. We can ask where that's taking the person and why they think that is. Because there's a lot of people, you know, even though we're told that there's certain roles in society that are supposed to be or healthy and protective, and they're not always. Not everybody is capable of that. Now, it's not to rationalize away the negligence and ignorance. No, it's to acknowledge these things happen for reasons. And it is understanding the reason for tragedy in any way, erasing the pain and suffering and indignity and the crime on a person's psyche? No. Masonry, in a lighter way. Your experience of the craft is something that I can only appreciate if I understand, if I have a chance to listen to you. Not the normal kinds of things, you know, which is tempered with defensiveness, you know. Here's what it is because as if it's a dominant thought. It's your thought, and that's perfectly free, reasonable. It's all that you have, isn't it? Your perspective. The fact that you've weighed in on a process, a way of thinking, maybe Freemasonry, that allows us to, as the philosophers would do, to examine these thoughts. We begin to ask more profoundly, is what I'm saying and thinking, what I'm doing, ethical? Is my thinking truthful or is it fanciful? Is it all just a belief? Am I defined just the way I say I am? If I say I am genuine, then therefore, who in the world are you to challenge me? And I can go along with that false sense of pride. Huh? You know, the indignity of that. You know, I can become quite indignant about anything, even though you're trying to be thoughtful. It's not hard. And unfortunately, we see displays of this kind of vulgarity too often through social media, And there will be those who will immediately a comment like that will raise their hackles. You know, who are you to judge? Well, I'm just breathing and I make judgments just like everybody else all the time. All the time. There's hardly a breath that we can take without making judgments. And I think it's reasonable to ask if it's if we can acknowledge that the uniqueness without falling into combat, without this this authoritarian right or wrong, good or bad, with me or against me kind of thinking. That's a motif for a lot of people. I tend to think that there's some certainty when you have somebody that speaks definitively, even though without asking you to weigh the proposition for yourself. Here, I'm convinced of this. And together we can do something very, very important. Don't ask how we're going to get there. And we've seen that type of approach put into play a lot. And we're seeing it recycled again now with lulls. In between, we have lulls that we refer to as peace, but they're not. They're not in the explicit sense of the term. We see we have a lot of reason that people will manipulate, will want to manipulate the message. Oh, we can when it's the enemy, it's over there, it's propaganda. When we're doing it, it's informing the public. At some point, we can say, well, it all doesn't matter. You know, we'll just go along with whatever is the easy road, whatever is the less complicated. And I'll decide my own mind, thank you, if it's less complicated. And so the form of that is put out in front of us. Well, think that way about gun control or about abortion issues or about religious conflict or racism. Oh, the sensitivity, I think, to discuss accurately, openly, honestly, truthfully what's happening, it usually it takes us to a point where we're wondering, you know, what comes next. What comes next? What do we do? You know, we haven't been able to find the elixir to erase or eradicate these deeds that this detract and we're going to see, you know, if we look down the road, we see that for quite legitimate reasons, people can have different points of view, which they do, which can lead to conflict and tensions. How do we live with that? Is every kind of conflict sufficient, a matter of pride? And so we're arming ourselves and going out to the OK Corral to battle it out. Is it the duel? Is that the only way? Everything, every conflict is life and death. Or do we know? Do we even know the essentials? Well, this kind of conversation doesn't happen in ignorance. It doesn't. We need to creep up on it to gradually influence the conversation, very gradually. Shawshank Redemption. Remember that kind of, you know, who is this guy? And the juxtaposition of such... something so beautiful in a cage. In a cage. What's the cage? Well, is it superstition? Is it pride? Is it ignorance? You know, or all three? There you have it. the joy has to be that the conversation goes on, and you know we can do things when we have that unending conversation, and we learn how to be accepting, and we learn about our own biases and prejudices. We can actually teach ourselves patience, and we can teach ourselves how to control our emotion. We can teach ourselves by examining what happens to our thinking when we are rash and we start to think emotionally instead of logically and reasonably. Hmm. Those are the kinds of things that have no, you know, if we were the 25-year-old sitting around in the pub, we might come to this kind of conversation toward the end of the night, or but if you've ever sat at a table where you've by accident fallen into an intelligent conversation, and then the next time you're together with the boys or girls, it's intelligent conversation. There's a degree of respect that's built up. It's not like somebody is declaring this is what we're going to do every single time. What's happening is this effort put out there to ensure, to preserve those relationships. To preserve a relationship, you let things slide, you know, especially if you're best friends. Their awkward sense of humor, you think, oh, what a jerk. But it's not like it ends the relationship. It's like, he also thinks you might think your sense of humor is, you know, or you're one of you are a Mets fan, one of you are a Yankees fan, or Milan, or you know, your differences aren't that great. They're unique. They're kind of interesting. We preserve. If we don't, then we force the relationship breaks down. It's about knowing that when to just absorb it. It's just the difference. It's not like there's a dominant force in the room that's going to compel another person to surrender their own beliefs for the sake of what? Of that kind of a, and call that a healthy relationship. No. In our lodges, we do that all the time. We have, and when we reach the point where we're fulfilling, you know, we just find the whole experience fulfilling, we don't have these conversations as much, but we know that they're there. We don't have them because they're not so essential. There's another problem that's on the horizon. And after we sort that one out, another problem that's on the horizon. These things, the work that we've accomplished doesn't dissolve, but it takes a more appropriate place in our thinking and in our being. They scare the hell out of me when I see these folks that are, you know, fire and brimstone types of masons. They just, oh, geez, here we go again, you know. Oh, God, you know, I'll try and keep my eyes open here and get out of the room. I'm not looking for the connection with the topic. I'm thinking, this is just so random. And it's not that it's the randomness of it, because it's the fact that what's triggered in my thinking is the speaker doesn't seem to have listened, doesn't seem to have asked. I think that some of that is politeness, but you want to know, you know, can we focus on this together? Can we come together so I can talk about my golf game or Hiram Abiff or the development of the third degree? Or the role of, or is Freemasonry misogynist? Not every moment. I might walk in thinking, oh, gee, I'm going to listen to La Traviata. Oh, beautiful. I'm just going to sit here and put on my headphones and absorb, you know, I'm just truth. But to think, you know, I'm just going to assume that everybody in the room is going to like it because I do, that would be impolite. It would also be thoughtless. However, if you talk about it, if we're in a setting where we're learning and exploring together, that's different. That's different. Bring out a piece of music, my brother, that tells me, without any conversation, tells me about you. Give me a list of five books, titles, that have influenced you in life. Influenced you. What speaks about you? What reveals you? Now, to do that, I think, can you imagine? Now, that kind of question sets our minds up to be searching for the uniqueness. Aha! I knew he was folk music. I knew it. What does that say about the person? Well, that's on you, isn't it? And what is the person? What was the message they were trying to send? Because they have an idea. This is the message, you know. This is the movie title. So this movie captures me, and this is how it. But without explaining that, I might have a completely different reckoning. And how do we compare? And which one is accurate? At the end of the day, isn't it? So today, with this kind of a program, it's always teetering on that. Luminous, huh? That sense of becoming, the sense of the tensions, the divine tensions. Aside, we have a show to put on today, and I hope you're receptive to seeing to these some of these themes here. Conveying a sense of the meaning of masonry for me through poetry, through a narrative, through a commentary and a bit of history, and we'd need some way of connecting so that we can find out if the message that I've been sending is, what you think and where we overlap. Sit back and relax and let us do some work for you today. And it's an absolute pleasure. Oh, and did I happen to mention that we have listeners from China? I know. I know. Dave Brubeck, eh? How do you do this? It's just to put the program on pause, and we're going to sit back for another, for 2 hours and 15 minutes and listen to the essential Dave Brubeck. You know, that we would do. Where could we find a better use for our time? We'd argue. But I digress. That's a remarkable piece of music, too. Talented people. Good guy. Good, nice man. Very, very nice man. I think today the commentary is, I won't give you full disclosure, but some disclosure. Once upon a time, I had the pleasure working with people that would be looking for help, looking for answers. In just trying to help people identify, it's not like you're a guru or, you know, you're the oracle. It requires, you know, understanding the individual and what their unique way of thinking. Who is this person? What's going on? But the point I make here is that what you see on the surface is often not what exists or what is under the surface. So, you know, you can glibly say, well, which is the truth? Well, they both are in a way. They both are. So it prompted me, that kind of thinking prompted me to title this, All Is Not What It Seems. And I was applying it to that world of experience with what is happening in masonry. And when I think about, I've been very, very fortunate. And perhaps some of that was self-induced, to put myself into some audiences where the people were just so excited about their findings, their research, their work, whether it's, I won't throw around names. It's not flattering and it's unnecessary. But there are some brilliant things happening in our community. And we'll pick up on that theme of community later. But for sure, finding our community within the community is important. In an ideal world, I would be with a lodge that is aware. Mm-hmm. This, and you would say, whose version of that? Eh? This awareness would translate into respect for the varieties of possibilities that are taken up by serious-minded gentlemen in pursuit of happiness. Don't exactly walk around town saying, oh, by the way, I'm a serious-minded gentleman in pursuit of happiness. You do if you're at the bottom of a bottle of scotch or you've imbibed in some type of... No, you might be more likely to bump into somebody that's going to say, sometimes it's just we create problems for ourselves. Serious-minded gentleman. So put yourself in that frame of mind, serious-minded person. Do I know whether what I profess as truth is actually belief? Do I assume that my beliefs are complete and not snippets? Do I accept that I can find contentment exploring a better understanding of virtue? What in the world? How then can I declare myself a virtuous man if I don't know what it is? But if you ask the questions, I have one for you in return. How much time do I have to respond? Do you want the first reaction that comes to mind? Or are you looking for a qualified opinion? What if I'm reconsidering your questions as if for the first time? Are you wanting explanations? In exchange, what can I expect from you? Will you bring out compatibility in what I'm saying or attack variations between your own thoughts of which I have no knowledge? Are you creating an exercise to judge? What question are you attempting to answer? There's no accounting for taste. It is a charming way of reminding us each individual has their own, and it is legitimate as far as opinions go. Are you seeking truth? How do we know if an opinion is in fact the truth? Do we agree on this formula? Won't this bring out passionate reactions? Won't this be best discussed by men able to control their emotion? Or are we able to participate, assuming change is still in play? That maturity of thinking is evolving constantly. It's not to say, when you think about this kind of commentary, it's not to say that somebody speaking rashly is wrong. When they're speaking rashly, do you see the agitation? Do you see how they're building up that energy to overcome a reluctance or a fear of being judged? Until it just explodes. And do we listen attentively to calm the person, to reassure them, or do we just push back? Too often we push back because we misread. I think to be generous, I'm thinking we often misread, especially if we're not sort of, you know, our heads in the clouds, literally and or figuratively, and we're off in our own thought process, and something unexpected. Well, the unexpected is unexpected, is expected, and well, give us. Do we have a moment just to resolve the newness and to, you know, find that context? We've got to catch up here. So we're not just being jumped. We're not just being assaulted with these ideas. You know, we see that with interviews. Interviewers catching an unsuspecting person with very, very provocative questions and smugly acting as if they were quite right in discovering truth. Well, you know, we manufacture that too, don't we? All depends on the caliber of the conversation. Earl Hines is going to help us with this. This is You Are Too Beautiful. Thank you. Ha ha. That's Earl Hines, in case you're wondering. It's from a recording he did on his own piano at home in 1969. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. What if I ask you to think for a moment about bravery and courage of a performer? That'd be all right. I want you to think about the what kind of temperament and training does it take when your adrenaline is just flowing full stop, when you are so excited and you have been preparing for this moment for a long, long time, and you're not just being judged, but you have all of these eyes, these faces turned toward you with a sense of anticipation, looking up. And you're going to perform in a way that it just elevates, that creates this connection with an audience. How do you have that intimate moment? You can do it one-on-one or one and two, just a small group. But imagine being able to do that with a theater of, let's say, 800 people. That intimate, that exquisite expression that just fills the soul, fills the heart and the mind, and people are transformed when they walk away. Like they know that something important, something vital has happened, that they've witnessed something special. Now, the courage of the performer. You've heard about these singers, the great singers who would be ill, physically ill, before they stepped on stage. We don't want to think that picture when we're in this kind of a conversation, but the tension, or the people that have that demon in their head, I can't do this, I have to, what if I screw up, what if I miss a note, what all the doubts. And then all of a sudden, if they're fortunate and they have a group of people around them that care, and they'll be asked, but all of that aside, you have something else. All of that, yes, all of those questions, all those doubts are always there, but you have something else. And you know it from the bottom of your feet to the tip of your nose. You know this to be true. You know. And after a while, you'd think, well, after 1,000 performances, would that wear thin? Talk to performers, or if they trust you enough to talk to you, no, the excitement, that tension, it's like a responsibility for this conversation. How does a person walk out on the stage and begin a conversation with you and I that just connects? I wanted to do this song, or they tell us anecdotes about the material that they do. Well, this is a poem today, an unusual poem by a very unusual and special woman, Elizabeth Barrett. She was an interesting woman, not out of the period of so-called advancement and rights of women that we have today, but 19th century. And her life was the stuff of legend, yeah? Yeah, truly. She married a poet, Robert Browning, in his own right, a statement. This is a woman. This is a poem. You do the work, you know, look into Elizabeth Barrett Browning, if you choose. She was sort of hanging around. She was in circles, literary circles, where there were introductions to some interesting people. So Samuel Coleridge and Browning and, you know, those, she married the guy, Browning, of course. But this is a poem that she did bravely. There wasn't a template for this. It wasn't like she was following and trying to fit in. It's not the 44 sonnets that she presented to her husband. No, she did that a year in 1847, a year after they secretly eloped to Italy. Can you imagine? There's some autobiographical material and all of that. This is Aurora Leigh, and this is what's called a blank verse poem, a novel in blank verse, if you can imagine. It's not just that this poet is telling us about a scene. You know, it's not just that field of daffodils that you come along the riverbank and there's all these daffodils and they're dancing in the wind and they seem so happy and it's just joyful. You know, somebody that can appreciate that color and motion. In that moment, this is an entire novel done with that. 11,000 lines, that kind of detail. First person, and this tells of the heroine's childhood and youth in Italy and England, and her self-education in her father's hidden library, and her successful pursuit of a literary career. So in this story, initially she's resisting a marriage proposal by the philanthropist Romney Lee. Aurora later surrenders her independence and weds her faithful suitor, whose own idealism has also since been tempered by experience. Aurora's career, Romney's social theories, and melodramatic subplot concerning forced prostitution elicit the author's vivid observations of the importance of poetry, the individual's responsibility to society, and the victimization of women. And although at the time when this came out in 1857, the critics just slaughtered it, they hated it, it was a remarkable popular success. So listen for the it's a concentration of imaginative awareness of experience or a specific emotional response. So search. I'm not going to get into much of it here. Meaning, what it speaks to, just at the beginning here. In those days, though, it begins, I never analyzed myself even. All analysis comes late. She knows me. You catch a sight of nature earliest in full front sun phase, and your eyelids wink and drop before the wonder of you miss the form through seeing the light. You miss the form through seeing the light. I lived those days and wrote because I lived unlicensed else. My heart beat in my brain. Life's violent flood abolished bounds in which my neighbors feel, which mine, what mattered. It was so in youth. We play at leapfrog over the God term. The love within us and the love without are mixed and confounded. If we are loved or love, we scarce distinguish. So with other power being acted on and acting seem the same, in that first onrush of life's chariot wheels, I know not if the forests move or we. And so, like most young poets, in a flush of individual life, I poured myself along the veins of others and achieved mere lifeless imitations of life verse. I made the living answer for the dead, profaning nature. Touch not, do not taste, nor handle. You're too legal. Who write young? I beat the formics until we hurt our thumbs, and If still ignorant of counterpoint, we call the muse, O muse, benignant muse, as if we had seen her purple braided head with the eyes in it start between the boughs, as if a stag's. What make-believe, with so much earnest, what effete results, what virile efforts, what cold wire-drawn odes. So my goodness, I don't know how to stop reading this, and I have to, I must. Where do you go? Better never to let somebody influence you, and never to let a poet influence you. You do all the time, though. You know, we tune in our favorite songs. Often the lyrics are so beautifully put together. Short poems, often one sentence repeated over and over. My cheating heart, you know, you've done me wrong, or daddy, I'm so in love with him. I want to marry this boy, but you're too young, my daughter. And I love you dearly, but you're too young. Or does he love you tonight? Does he love you the way I love him? Thank you. Another beautiful piece of music from the 50s. That's a recording from 1957, Miles Davis, of course, round about midnight. Beautiful, beautiful piece of music. Now, this is the time in the program where we turn to a snippet of history. And we've been tracing along the careful records, through the careful records of lodges in the Netherlands, the progress of masonry being introduced into a world that had not seen anything like it before. And there was concern. Governments and religious leaders were concerned about this new type of law, this new type of control. They in the past had been the source of control and interpretation and meaning. And here we're finding groups of men gathering around their own, creating their own versions of laws and saying these are legitimate. We're not about to try and attempt any kind of overthrow. In fact, we're devout in our own way. And it's not a question of our loyalty. No, this was difficult for authorities to understand, because the defenders of the faith would say this is obviously a threat. This is a threat to integrity, and it requires compromise of authority. And here we're looking at Le Bien Ami Lodge in the year 1755. And we've already known about that it triggered a strong response from some sectors in society, like, you know, as here we quote, a slanderous public, evil-minded hypocrites, prejudiced writers, frightened rulers, cursed Inquisition, thundering Vaticans, and booming preachers. Yeah, they had their work cut out. So this was, there was criticism. So Schroeder's, and we're talking about Johann Schroeder. He was lecturing his brothers at the annual feast. He's a pivotal Mason of the day, attempting to bring legitimacy and stabilize. And he's saying, well, it is, the work is legitimate because we're appealing. Other lodges are supporting, and people want to join me and want to join us. And other lodges, in fact, are recognizing what we're doing. So even Freemasons from other countries visited the lodge and signed in. So he's saying there's legality and legitimization. Because of the representation of the other lodges. The law that Schroeder refers to here has nothing to do with the laws of the country. Oh, these are laws and legality being created in the private realm of men for other men by the lodges themselves. Masonic law was taken most seriously by the brothers. And in 1756, when the reconstituted lodge was quarreling with the Grand Lodge in The Hague over allegiance to it, what was at stake between them were what they described as legitimization and sovereignty, the rule of law and the nature of duly constituted authority. In this instance, we should riff on that. We should talk about that, duly constituted authority, because we're seeing that held up and examined as if that is now optional and it's not clear. And I think it's reasonable to ask, how do we revisit this? The legitimization of the lodge, of this new civil society that it was referred to, depends more upon its legality than upon its traditions, or upon the quality and birthright of its masters. And by the 1760s, the Grand Lodge would extend its legal prerogatives nationally and assume the power to adjudicate between plaintiffs and defendants, even awarding damages to the defendant when he was absolved of the accusations against his person. So we see in 1755, there were some minutes of Les Bien-Aimés meetings that bear out the relevance of Schroeder's oration about legitimacy. And in 1754, members of the disbanded lodge met, consulted, and deliberated with each other and decided to request that the very vulnerable master, Brother Rousset de Missy, out of his power and authority by an authentic document or certificate, would grant and authorize them to form a regular lodge, and would, for his part, appoint a brother in his name and for his part to reopen the closed lodge, to form the brothers into a legal lodge and in person to act as their venerable and master. Accordingly, Schroeder wrote to Rousset, still exiled in a small town outside of Utrecht, and asked his permission to reopen the lodge. He responded with, quote, a true joy. We approve thus the proposition that he, Schroeder, has made for your part, and we consent very willingly to the request of our honorable brothers. Rousset then named Pierre Bunel as the master of the lodge, at the same time urging his brothers not to permit the pernicious innovations which false brothers seek to introduce. He begged them to attach themselves to the English constitutions. We recommend you to its paternal care. Rousset railed in particular against what he called gallantry, which he equated with French excesses. In the rules adopted by the lodge in 1756, the term appears along with religion and politics as specifically forbidden to be discussed. And in the years these discussions are taking place, the term would mean sexual license. It would also imply frivolity, a lack of seriousness of purpose. In this Masonic context, Rousset juxtaposed gallantry as the antithesis of a modern virtuous lifestyle. Gallantry as the antithesis of a modest and or virtuous lifestyle. Curious. This is John Baptiste. He has his piano propped up in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, and he's singing What a Wonderful World. Anyway, it's time to wrap up this version of Masonic Effects. I hope it's been some reminder or prompt or interest to you. It's It's a big world that we're part of, isn't it? It's just so, so huge. And we see contradiction around us. We also see goodness with us. We see people striving to live a good life. And it's curious. Man, it's curious. And so today, to the people tuning in, and I'll just go through this briefly, from Latvia and Netherlands and UK and Ireland and New Zealand and South Sudan and Oman and Iran, Turkey, the United States and Canada and China. To listeners that are tuning in, there is common purpose in resolving our conflicts at the table and negotiating, and there is purpose in patience pursuing this ideal, pursuing this practice. And as our communication increases, our knowledge of not just what governments tell us, but are the findings that we know of each other, the lives that we live, we find that we're not so different. There are zealots out there that stir things up for all of us. So we have to find some way of curtailing that or rechanneling that kind of energy and concern. And that's not easy, I think. Certainly, none of these tasks are daunting, but time either is running out, if I look at it as a lifetime like mine, or it's just expanding. And one day I may even understand what it is that's expanding. Because right now, I can't really chase it down because I'm not really sure what it is, except I've been taught that it's passing, and that I want to do the best I can with the time I have left. Thank you for sitting in, and I hope we've made some kind of connection with you, with minds out there. If you're prone to seeing this as confirming suspicions, then so be it. But the intention is otherwise. It's to find something beautiful that we can agree upon. Finding a respect for what's happening around us. Understanding that the struggles that happen around the world are a request for us to provide example. If, for example, you're in a war zone, look to us as the example of the benefits of peace. Don't think for a moment that any of us that are enjoying a peace have not paid the price for it. Oh, yeah, some more so than others. And some, it seems almost ironic that they would revisit the battlefront after the sacrifices that made by their nations. You would think that they would be so frightened of conflict. And sometimes that translates into building walls and staying behind and arming yourself so that in your mind you can tell yourself that there's no more possible threat, but it plays heavily and there is always a threat. And of course, if you're prone to that, you're going to look, and every time you look for something, you're going to find it. As we've talked about with from art to the battlefield, if I send you out to look for something, you're intelligent enough, you'll find it. So here I'm sending you out with a message. Find the beauty around you. Find the purpose within yourself and the respect that you deserve. And let that be a lesson. I hope you're satisfied with your. I really do hope you're satisfied with yourselves, gentlemen. I really do. I think it's wonderful just to have this opportunity together. See you.